In your family practice clinic, you are seeing Ethan, a 65-year-old man with a history of chronic heart failure, who is complaining of worsening shortness of breath. "I've been down in the dumps since my wife died," he tells you. "I don't have anyone to talk to at home, so I've just been sitting in my recliner in front of the television, watching old movies and drinking one soda after another. I can't sleep in my bed anymore because I end up gasping for breath unless I'm propped up." Ethan's heart rate is 92 per minute, and his blood pressure is 100 over 60 millimeters of mercury. On physical exam, you hear diffuse crackles and detect 3+ pitting edema. You consider the underlying mechanism of Ethan's symptoms, and your wheels start turning. You're thinking about his stroke volume and end diastolic volume, and how they have both been affected by his pathology, and how they may explain his symptoms. Welcome to Audio Bricks. I'm Laurel Toft, bringing cardiology from our bricks to your ears. But first, a quick shout out to the learning platform that makes Audio Bricks possible, the RX Bricks, which is the source of all content you hear on this podcast. If you've been holding off on checking this out, right now we're running a promotion where you can get a full Bricks subscription for 50% off using the code RXPOD. That's RX Pod, you know, like the RX Podcast. The link to the Bricks is in the show notes, along with the promo code. After completing this section, you will be able to 1. Define cardiac output, stroke volume, and heart rate. 2. Explain contractility and how it is controlled. 3. Explain preload and what determines it. And 4. Explain afterload and what determines it. Part 1. What are the components of cardiac output? If we want to understand cardiac physiology, it is crucial to understand how cardiac output, which is the volume of blood pumped out of the heart per unit time, changes to meet the body's demands. The cardiac output is a main determinant of both the systemic blood pressure and the blood flow. So cardiac output is key to perfusing tissues with the oxygen and nutrients carried in the blood. The cardiac output is maintained by multiple factors, which can be categorized as those that are intrinsic to the heart, such as strength of contraction, heart rate, and those that are extrinsic to the heart, such as blood volume. Before we explore these factors in depth, let's first look at how we can calculate the cardiac output. The cardiac output is the volume of blood pumped into the aorta per unit time. This can be expressed in the following equation. Cardiac output equals stroke volume times heart rate. Now, that equation is so central, let me say it again. Cardiac output equals stroke volume times heart rate. Now, stroke volume is the volume of blood expelled from the heart during one heartbeat and is expressed in milliliters. The average is between 60 to 100 milliliters for an average-sized individual. Stroke volume is determined by three main factors: contractility, preload, and afterload. Each of these factors is in turn regulated by a number of other parameters. Now, going back to our equation, the other component of the cardiac output equation is heart rate. Heart rate is the number of heartbeats per unit of time and is usually expressed in beats per minute. The range in healthy adults is 60 to 100 beats per minute. That's easy to remember because the average stroke volume and the average heart rate are in the same range, 60 to 100. Heart rate is regulated by the autonomic nervous system. Stimulation by the sympathetic nervous system increases the heart rate, whereas stimulation by the parasympathetic nervous system decreases it. This is achieved by altering the firing rate of the sinoatrial node. Using the metrics that we just covered, we can conclude that the average cardiac output is about 4 to 8 liters per minute for a healthy adult, but you can just remember the number 5 liters per minute as a quick average. Since the average blood volume is about 5 liters, this means that the heart circulates all of the blood in your body in 1 minute. Wow! All right, question time. How do we calculate cardiac output? Answer is cardiac output equals stroke volume times heart rate. Let's move on to discuss the key factors that determine stroke volume: contractility, preload, and afterload. Part 2. What is contractility? Now it's time to explore some of the factors intrinsic to the heart itself that control cardiac output. First up, cardiac contractility. Cardiac contractility is the intensity of ventricular contraction at a given or specific end diastolic volume. It's mostly determined by the amount of calcium available in the cytoplasm of cardiomyocytes. More calcium available leads to greater contractility, and vice versa. This is because calcium entry into cells driven by the action potential is the main determinant of actin-myosin motion that causes cardiomyocyte contraction. Quick clinical correlation. One of the oldest known drugs to man is digoxin, coming from the digitalis plant. This drug is what we call an inotrope, which means it increases contractility, and it does this in part by increasing intracellular calcium. Unlike heart rate or stroke volume, contractility is not measured directly in clinical medicine, but changes in contractility can be inferred from a patient's clinical status. For example, if the measured stroke volume falls without changes in estimated blood volume or blood pressure, it could be inferred that the contractility has declined. Contractility of the heart is primarily regulated by the autonomic nervous system. The sympathetic nervous system increases the contractility of both the atria and the ventricles by activating beta-1 adrenergic receptors on the cardiomyocytes. When the sympathetic neurotransmitter norepinephrine binds its cardiomyocyte receptor, it initiates a signaling pathway that leads to increased intracellular calcium. This explains its inotropic effect. In contrast, the parasympathetic nervous system has an overall weak negative inotropic effect that primarily involves the atria. Part 3. What is preload? After each cardiac contraction, the ventricles relax to fill with blood from the atria. This inflow of blood stretches the walls of the ventricles. The degree of ventricular stretching at the end of diastole is referred to as preload. You might hear people refer to preload as a volume, but it's actually this stretch of the walls, which is caused by volume of blood in the ventricles. The key to preload is the stretch on a cardiomyocyte. The stretch of a sarcomere, or you can also think of it as sarcomere length, affects the force of contraction of the cell, estimated by its active tension. Active tension just means how well it contracts after a stimulus like a nervous impulse. An increase in sarcomere length results in greater active tension and thus greater force of contraction in cardiomyocytes. This is only up to a certain point. The sarcomeres can be stretched to a point where force of contraction doesn't increase. So, if we're looking at the curve relating stretch on the x-axis with contraction force on the y-axis, the curve is an upward slope ending in a plateau. So that explains preload or stretch for an individual cardiomyocyte. But what about stretch in the whole ventricle? Well, this is where preload can be estimated by either the end diastolic volume, EDV, or the end diastolic pressure, EDP. Let's see if you got that. Question: what two parameters can be used for the estimation of preload? Answer is end diastolic volume, EDV, and end diastolic pressure, EDP. So, the whole point of understanding preload is to understand its impact on cardiac output. To do that, we need to investigate how preload affects stroke volume. By increasing the stretch of the ventricles, preload also increases the stretch of the individual sarcomeres. This increases the number of actin and myosin cross bridges formed, which depends on the sarcomere length. More cross bridges equals greater contractile force generated. Think about the analogy of a rubber band to help you understand this. When a rubber band is stretched, tension builds up before it snaps back. Stretching the band more will lead to increased tension and therefore a stronger snap. Likewise, more preload or stretch increases the force that the cardiomyocyte can generate during systole. High preload increases the stroke volume, which increases cardiac output. So if we now look at the whole heart, not just the isolated sarcomere, we see the same relationship between stretch and force. This brings us to one of the crucial laws governing cardiac mechanics, the Frank-Starling law. The Frank Starling Law uses the concept of preload to explain the relationship between stroke volume and end-diastolic volume. This law can be plotted as a relationship between stroke volume and ventricular end-diastolic volume, or preload, at a constant afterload, yielding the Frank Starling curve. So here, the x-axis is preload as estimated by end-diastolic volume, and the y-axis is stroke volume. As end-diastolic volume increases, so does the stroke volume, creating an upward-sloping line. At the limits of volume, the line actually plateaus, showing that further increase in stretch does not generate as great an increase in stroke volume. The shape of this curve overall is like a gentle hill. Now, if you will remember the shape of the previous curve for the individual sarcomere, you'll note that these two curves essentially look the same. And therefore, the two curves give us the same conclusion. Increases in preload cause increases in stroke volume. All right, quick quiz time. Question: what relationship is represented by the Frank Starling Law? Answer is, the Frank Starling Law describes the relationship between preload and stroke volume. So, since we've learned how preload affects stroke volume and therefore cardiac output, let's dive deeper into what factors determine preload. Because the venous system fills the heart, anything that increases the amount of venous blood returning to the heart during diastole will increase the end-diastolic volume and therefore preload. Some factors that might increase preload would include increased total blood volume, increased venous pressure, or decreased intrathoracic pressure. The first of these, blood volume, is most important clinically. People who are dehydrated or have hemorrhaged will have low blood volume, therefore low preload, therefore low stroke volume. This explains why they may be dizzy or have low blood pressure, since blood is not being pumped out effectively to the organs. The venous pressure can be increased by the increase in blood volume or also by the contraction of venous smooth muscle cells by the sympathetic nervous system. And finally, the last factor, decreased intrathoracic pressure, will increase the driving force of pressure returning blood to the heart, because that pressure is venous pressure minus the intrathoracic pressure. When you take a deep breath in, the intrathoracic pressure drops, so venous blood return to the heart increases because there is a greater driving pressure, and thereby preload increases. And so will the stroke volume. This is an appropriate response, since increased stroke volume will serve to empty the heart of the extra blood. Let's do a quick quiz question before we move on. How will a blood transfusion affect the stroke volume? Blood transfusion would increase the blood volume, which will increase venous return to the heart, increasing end-diastolic volume. This means an increase in preload and consequently the stroke volume and, finally, cardiac output. Part 4. What is afterload? The pressure against which the ventricle must work to eject blood from the heart is referred to as afterload. The greater the afterload, the more pressure the ventricles must generate for outflow to occur. In normal physiology, afterload is mostly determined by the total resistance in the circulation, termed systemic vascular resistance, or SVR. This can be estimated in most cases by the arterial blood pressure. High afterload, for example, due to high blood pressure, will reduce the cardiac stroke volume. This makes sense. If the pressure is higher in the aorta and the cardiac contraction force stays the same, less blood will be ejected before the ventricle and aorta reach equivalent pressures, causing ejection to stop. Let's think about this in terms of Frank Starling curves. If afterload is increased, the entire curve flattens, meaning it shifts downward and to the right. So at the same preload or end-diastolic volume on the x-axis, more afterload means that the stroke volume decreases. The reverse happens if we reduce afterload. The Frank Starling curve becomes steeper. The entire curve is shifted upward and to the left. So at the same preload or end-diastolic volume on the x-axis, less afterload means the stroke volume increases. But why does afterload affect stroke volume? An increase in afterload slows the velocity of fiber shortening during a ventricular contraction. Think of the heart pumping against a barrier. This decrease in fiber shortening velocity reduces the rate of blood ejection during systole. This means that more blood is left within the ventricle at the end of systole, also known as increased end systolic volume. This will decrease the stroke volume because not as much blood has been ejected. So what factors determine afterload? The main parameter that increases afterload is increased systemic vascular resistance, SVR, which is largely determined by contraction of the small arterioles. For example, sympathetic nerve stimulation or circulating hormones like vasopressin can constrict the smooth muscle that surrounds the small arterioles, constricting them and increasing SVR. People with high blood pressure, called hypertension, often have increased SVR and high afterload. This reduces stroke volume and puts more strain on the heart. All right, clinical correlation time. The valvular disease aortic stenosis also increases afterload. As people age, their aortic valves may become calcified and narrowed. This creates resistance to blood exiting the heart during systole and increases the afterload. Aortic stenosis will therefore reduce stroke volume and cardiac output, and patients may become dizzy or even pass out, called syncope. Let's try one more question before we wrap things up. How would an increase in afterload affect the stroke volume? An increase in afterload would decrease stroke volume. And that's it for contractility, preload, and afterload. Let's check your knowledge and see what you've learned today. First, can you define cardiac output? Cardiac output is the volume of blood pumped out of the heart per unit time. It is calculated as cardiac output equals stroke volume times heart rate. Next, what is stroke volume and what three factors determine it? Stroke volume is the volume of blood expelled from the heart during one heartbeat. Its three main determinants are contractility, preload, and afterload. Now, can you define contractility? Contractility is the force generated by the heart to pump the blood at a given preload and afterload. It estimates the intrinsic strength of the heart muscle. Now, what main factor controls contractility? Increased sympathetic nerve stimulation results in increased intracellular calcium levels, leading to increased contractility. Increased contractility increases the cardiac contractile force, stroke volume, and therefore cardiac output. Next, what is preload and how is it estimated clinically? Preload is the degree of ventricular stretching at the end of diastole. It is approximated by the end diastolic volume, EDV, or end diastolic pressure, EDP. Now, how does increased preload, ventricular stretching, lead to increased contractility? Stretching of the sarcomeres increases the overlap between actin and myosin. This increases the number of cross bridges formed and leads to greater contractile force and tension. Now, what is afterload and how is it measured clinically? Afterload is the resistance against which the heart pumps. Afterload is approximated by the systemic vascular resistance, SVR, or systemic blood pressure. And finally, how does increased afterload impact stroke volume and cardiac output? Increased afterload decreases both stroke volume and cardiac output. And we're done. Armed with your newfound knowledge, let's think back to your patient from the beginning of this episode. Remember, you are seeing Ethan, who has come in with worsening symptoms of heart failure. How has his condition of heart failure impacted his stroke volume and end diastolic volume? How can you use that knowledge to guide his treatment? Ethan has a decreased stroke volume due to weakened contractile force from a failing heart. This decreased stroke volume has led to more blood left in the ventricle at the end of systole, or increased end systolic volume, In turn, that has built into increased end diastolic volume. Many of his symptoms are due to this increased volume, such as not being able to lie flat at night, called orthopnea, and shortness of breath, which is dyspnea due to pulmonary edema. You discuss fluid restriction to manage the increased end diastolic volume, and you also increase the dosage of diuretics or fluid management pills. When he follows up with 3 days later, he tells you that he is breathing much better and was actually able to sleep flat in his bed last night. His daughter visited him yesterday, and she's going to start taking him to a grief group for widows. He explains, "I'm not usually one to talk about myself, but maybe this group can help. I miss my wife, but she wouldn't want to see me like this." And that's our show. Make sure to like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts if you like what you heard. Remember, your feedback helps us improve. And again, now's your chance to get 50% off the RX Bricks by following the link in the show notes below and typing in the promo code RXPOD, like RX Podcasts. It's a huge discount on the written material that serves as the foundation of Audio Bricks, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. So go check it out if you haven't already and help keep Audio Bricks free. Until next time, friends.